The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to The Greg Hughes Show here on Highland Radio. We're with you for the next hour and 55 minutes, and we've got an awful lot to pack in for you. Coming up after 10 o'clock, we have our Friday panel, some very interesting guests, as always, running over some of the big stories of the day, the big stories of the week, the talking points. And we want you involved in that conversation and whatever else we have for you between now and 10. 086 60 25,000, that is your WhatsApp and your text number, a very familiar number, I hope, to you at this stage. But as I say, people tuning in all of the time. You can also give us a call on 07491 25,000, or email comments at highlandradio.com. And I just want to welcome you to get involved if you are listening to our overnight replay. Many of you do work alternative shifts. Maybe it's hard to get off to sleep for some. We love having you on board, of course, listening to us live, but delayed on Highland Radio. And our podcast available for you too on Spotify and iTunes. That's from pretty much around about noon. Okay. Right, let's have a look at some of the papers this morning. The Derry Journal: a young Derry family say they have been left frightened, angry and shocked after a sectarian attack forced them to flee their home, adding that they simply want to live in peace. Chloe Rutherford, her partner Darian Moore, and their three young children, one of whom is receiving palliative care, say they were shocked that in 2026 they could still be subjected to intimidation driven by sectarianism. On to the Nationals now, and I'd love to be reading this story in a defective concrete block context, but I'm not. It's about other issues with housing. And this isn't, by the way, this is in no way to begrudge people redress or recourse, but a $2.5 billion redress scheme for up to 100,000 owners of defective Celtic Tiger apartments will be brought before the Dáil in the coming months. And what is interesting about this is that it's further enhancing that scheme, broadening it out, unfortunately seemingly giving builders a pass. And there hasn't been a great deal of sort of campaigning in relation to this on a national scale, but yet it is bringing results in the East and Dublin-centric part of the world. Well, the government is planning to significantly strengthen an earlier version of the law ahead of a Dáil vote due to take place before the summer. However, developers involved in the building of defective apartments will be left off the hook and allowed to walk away with zero consequences, according to those affected. The laws are set to be passed almost 15 years after concerns were first raised with the scandal over the Priory Hall apartments in Dublin. It subsequently emerged that between 50 and 80% of apartments built between 1991 and 2013 had fire safety structural or water ingress defects. The Cabinet signed off on a proposed laws in 2024, but they've still not been enacted. This means thousands of people could be living in unsafe buildings, with one TD suggesting there is potential for a Grenfell tragedy here in Ireland. The Oireachtas Housing Committee has published a report on its pre-legislative scrutiny of the government's proposed apartments and duplex defects recommendation bill. However, the Coalition has already agreed to many of the recommendations. Now, the one thing I will say, and I could be wrong in relation to this because some of this is just coming from memory, the defective concrete block scheme, they skipped pre-legislative scrutiny, whereas now the government is awaiting the outcome of this scrutiny of this legislation. It's being strengthened, it's being enhanced. And why? Because they're concerned that there could be a fire risk, that these houses, these apartments, duplexes could be unsafe, that water could be getting into them. And these are the arguments the government themselves are using to strengthen this scheme. Now, fast forward or move north into Donegal and surrounds, where people are living in houses that have snow ingress, the cracks are that big. They've got rain ingress, the water is inside the house, the kids' bedrooms are covered in mould. It might not be a fire risk because the blocks are so dusty and damp, but certainly is a risk of a gable falling down on someone's head. And thousands of people are living in these homes, and it's a constant fight. It's a constant fight to try and just get what, you know, what seems in this case to be accepted as normal redress. Unfortunately, those responsible for it as well, those that constructed or cut corners in products, are getting away down in this Celtic Tiger Apartments controversy. But it's just interesting that the very language that campaigners up here fight to use as an argument to enhance the scheme up here is the language that's being used by the Oireachtas, by the experts, by TV, TDs and the government in relation to the controversy down there. And is no one sort of on a national level picking up on this and saying, well, what's the difference between the people of Donegal and other counties now and also those affected by these Celtic Tiger controversies? It's almost as if, you know, the government's moving forward themselves to try and address this whilst everyone up here is trying to argue its case to get the government to do what exactly they're doing down here. As I say, it's not something I was able to give a great deal of thought to because I only saw it in the papers an hour or so ago. But the difference, pre-legislative scrutiny, people in unsafe houses, water ingress, a potential Grenfell. You know, I understand something must be done, but what about the water ingress up here? What about the black mould in the bedrooms? And this isn't just private houses. These are publicly owned houses as well. What about the gables collapsing? What about the cornerstones coming off? What about the chimneys? What about the bison floor slabs? What about, you know, what happens when one of those slabs goes down on a family? You know, but still, it's very hard. It's very frustrating, and one has to mind the language just to be on the safe side. Okay, the Irish Daily Mail this morning. The government is seeking to fast-track the most significant reform to asylum legislation in the history of the state by bypassing Oireachtas Committee scrutiny. This is just by coincidence. Oireachtas scrutiny seems to be a choice. So if you want something to go through quickly and as you want it, you don't do scrutiny. And other times you go, yep, let's have that pre-legislative scrutiny. So just by pure coincidence, two completely different stories. But in this case, they want to bypass Oireachtas Committee scrutiny. The International Protection Bill, which was published in full last week after being approved by Cabinet, is due to be enacted by the end of June this year. At over 200 pages long, the legislation, which gives effect to the EU Migration Pact, is set to completely revamp the international protection system. Minister for Justice Jim O'Callaghan has called it the most significant reform of the Irish asylum laws in the state's history. But now it's emerged that the coalition is seeking to bypass the Oireachtas Justice Committee and take last stage of the legislation process on the floor of the Dáil, a mechanism usually only reserved for when the government wants to guillotine a piece of legislation. So let me just read that line again. As I say, this is completely coincidental, these two stories. But the reason often you bypass Oireachtas Justice Committee or any Oireachtas Committee scrutiny is a mechanism employed mostly when the government wants to guillotine a piece of legislation. So just think of that last story when hearing that. The Irish Times, Met Éireann Director Owen Moran and Minister for Housing James Brown have held talks in the wake of the minister's criticism of the forecaster, the forecasting service, during Storm Chandra. Mr. Brown said in a statement after the meeting that he recognised the important work that our meteorological teams and forecasting service does. The minister said on Wednesday that Met Éireann needed to improve its communication, and he suggested the forecaster had withheld information that would have helped with flood preparation. His comments on South East Radio sparked huge frustration within the forecaster. By the way, the forecaster is an arm of the state too. It receives millions upon millions, Met Éireann, that is, millions upon millions of euro every single year. They have data on flood potential, etc. They do not release it. And I know the likes of Alan O'Reilly, a regular guest on this programme, who's a amateur forecaster. He does it for free, whatever he might get off social media, but he does it for free for the most part. He's been a big advocate of this information being released, and in fact more machinery put in place right across the country so we can understand better when there is a flood risk. The government missed its housing completion targets by more than 4,000 homes last year, which falls significantly short of what's needed, the opposition has said. A total of 36,284 new houses and apartments were completed in 2025. New figures from the Central Statistics Office have revealed. After its formation in January last year, the coalition set a target of delivering 41,000 homes in 2025. But now what they've done away with annual targets, you can understand why. You know, you can't, if you're not meeting your targets, you don't give targets. Isn't that a logical idea, whether it's right or wrong? So they're about 4,000 short. But the government argues that it's the most houses built in a single year since 2018. So in effect, it is good news. What is interesting, or perhaps it's not interesting, is half of those homes were built in and around Dublin. Donal had figures for Donegal. I think it was 600 built last year across the various parts of County Donegal. 600 out of the 36-odd thousand. And as I say, the majority of those homes were built in Dublin or around it. And lastly, a man accused of sexually assaulting a teen, a 10-year-old girl, has been sent forward for trial. The 26-year-old non-Irish national appeared again at Cloverhill District Court for his ninth hearing. And the reason I'm mentioning this is this was the case that sparked those riots down in Dublin last year, you might remember. Justice is progressing is the reason I wanted to mention it. He was served with a book of evidence by the prosecution. Judge Anya Shannon remanded him in custody to appear at Dublin Circuit Criminal Court in May. Right, our first guest's going to be joining us on the show very shortly, but you may not be aware, I hope you are, but you may not be aware that there is a sister podcast to this programme, and we release a new episode every Friday, and there's some bonus content often released during the week. All the episodes, it's called The Greg Hughes Podcast, so that it aligns with this programme. It's available on our website. As I say, we're up to episode 4 or 5 at the moment, and it's just an opportunity to talk to, you know, real people about their real stories and to have a little bit more time to do so. So there are a number of episodes available there for you, and there is another episode going live at 11 a.m. This morning. And on this week's podcast, I talked to Bernadette Rice. Now, Bernadette very tragically lost her twin sister, Clarice, in a road traffic collision in 2019. They were both just 26 at that time. And since then, Bernadette has been a very strong road safety advocate and has been very vocal on the fact that speed was a significant factor in her sister's death. And in the podcast, we learn about the collision and how the family learnt of that, the distress of inaccurate reporting, which can happen, the family dealing with the loss, and Bernadette's road safety work. There's heartbreak in there. There's anger. There's hope. And I think just as we head into a public holiday, St. Bridget's weekend, where we are more likely, 11 people have lost their lives on the country's roads so far this year, we do see an uptick in terms of serious injury, road fatalities at a public holiday weekend. And maybe if someone listens to this today, it might just change their behaviour a little bit and avoid an unnecessary death. Just by way of a preview, here's just some of my conversation with Bernadette. Take us back to December 27th, 2019, as much as you're comfortable talking about it. I mean, this is obviously in between Christmas and the new year. It's the, you know, it's the time of, yeah, of joy and happiness, especially for younger people. Was she out that night, or what was the story?
I had been out the boxing night, and she took me home, and the next day, the 27th, she just come to see me. Like, she bought me like hangover food, and yeah, we just had a laugh, and my daughter and her daughter were playing with their Santa presents, and a mutual friend of ours, he came to my house, and it was decided then that himself and Clarice was going to head out to a few pubs and stuff. So she left my house. It was about 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening with Saoirse to take her down to our home place in Portsall, and then she managed to go to my mum's, and she left Saoirse there, and then she headed off with the mutual friend, and I went to my bed, and then I think it was roughly about 1:10 in the morning I got the phone call she died in a car crash. And
oh my God.
I just, yeah.
Who made that call to you? Was that your mum?
It was an aunt, actually.
Right.
My mum was at the scene. My mum just had a bad feeling. The accident happened roughly between 10 and 11 o'clock at night. Mum just, she had got word about a car accident, and she just took a really bad feeling. So she drove up there, and she just stood until it was confirmed then that it was Clarice.
And you can hear the entire interview with Bernadette Rice in our podcast, which is live on our website from 11 a.m. and will also be available too on Spotify and iTunes. And please subscribe on those platforms as well, as we've got some amazing guests coming up, some amazing stories as well. We're joined on the programme now by Fine Gael Senator Manus Boyle. Good morning, Manus. You are calling for an air ambulance.
Hello, good morning, Greg, and good morning to your listeners.
Okay, you're calling for an air ambulance to be based in Donegal. Why?
Yes, Greg, I found out that there's four new helicopters being delivered to, ordered by Ireland. And I'm calling for the government to put one in Ballyshannon up in Finner Camp as an air ambulance so they can cater for as an air ambulance. And I think it's very important for Donegal.
I suppose it would make sense, wouldn't it, given the geographical spread, the importance of quick access to medical care, but also too, I suppose, we often see the 118 off the north coast, off the west coast, a more northwest base would make good geographical sense.
Greg, and you know me, as long time I've been calling for extra ambulances here in South Donegal, because I feel that we're kind of left over here in Alum, and I think the ambulance would be a great asset to Donegal, the whole county, and even cross border in nearing counties if we got based in Ballyshannon. I mean, you're 100% right. The Coast Guard does such great work with transporting patients to Dublin, along with the Defence Forces. Without that, there'll be lives lost. So I think we badly need one here in Donegal. And that's why when I heard that these four was coming, that I got on to the Minister and I took it up at the Health Committee that one should be based in Finner Camp in Ballyshannon.
What did they say to you in response to that? Because is this four helicopters to replace those that are there? Is this to provide extra cover with conversations about where they might be based up for conversation? What is the situation?
Well, that's to provide extra cover and to upgrade what's there already. You know, they're going to have bigger flying distances, and they have the capability of search and rescue along with doing medical transfers. So I just basically heard about it a couple of days ago, and I've been working on it since. I've contacted the Ministers of Health and the Minister of Defence and asked them if they would take a real serious hard look at basing one in Donegal. As you said, geographically, we're on a limb up here. We badly need it. And I think it'll be very, very well used up here. The amount of accidents now on roads, it could land. You know, when you look at England there, I think it's 37 to 38 helicopters they have. And we haven't one up here. You know, I think one up here would be a game changer for us, Greg.
Have you had any response yet from the various parties you've contacted?
Well, the Defence Minister said she would have a look guard and she would come back to me. So I'm waiting on a response now from her. It's more a her issue than a health issue. But I did take it up at the Health Committee because I feel if I promote it there too, you know, the Minister for Health, she has a great grasp of Donegal and she can help me there too, you know.
Okay, well, we'll watch on with interest. Thank you very much indeed. That was Senator Manus Boyle there reiterating his calls for a air rescue helicopter to be located in South Donegal. On the issues of weather, a texter says, it's all about wind and rain now down south. We could be blown away, flooded and crumbling down defective concrete blocked houses, and little mention of it. Heard Boxamoran on national radio yesterday. Was Burnfoot sorted? Micah? People mention how Pierce Doherty has to raise his voice in Andal to get the message across. Perhaps if previous Donegal TDs didn't sit on their hands, all in the interests of their own parties, in my opinion, we'd have better services up here. That's the views of a listener, not my opinion. Excuse me. On the issues of schools, we had an issue with the school principal. We tried to lodge a complaint and we were sent to the school board. The principal is on the school board, so you're complaining to the person about the person. We spent 4 weeks going through the education board and going nowhere. We then went to the governors of the school, who completely agreed with everything we said, yet they too did nothing. Can anyone outline to me how we lodge a complaint about a school principal that's acted upon and taken seriously? There is a constant ring of sending you in circles, so you will drop it. Our next step is the Department of Education, but we know they will also return us to the school. Well, hopefully, if it was raised to the board and the principal is on the board, that they would take a step away because of a conflict of interest. The one thing I would keep in mind, and I have no idea where this school is, who's involved, or the people who have texted in, that it might be possible that, as important as this is to you, and whilst you might think some sort of action might need to be taken, I don't know the nature of the complaint, it is possible that those that you've raised it with have reviewed what you've said and maybe looked at the principal's work in the round and don't believe that they require any punishment or sanction or anything. So that is also a possibility. Sometimes we continue to try and achieve what we believe the outcome should be, and it's not always achievable. I'm not looking to dishearten or discourage you, per se, because I know nothing about the case, but sometimes maybe it's the case that others have reviewed it and they don't see the situation quite as you see it. But as I say, I don't know enough about it really to comment beyond that. One more before the break here. Hi, Greg. We were in a CAF in Letterkenny yesterday for breakfast. We ordered 2 poached eggs, beans, 2 slices of bacon for my wife, and 2 poached eggs, beans, and 2 slices of toast for me. They got my order wrong and gave me 2 slices of bacon as well. Okay, so no big problem. We also got 2 Americanos from the machine. The bill came to, how much do you think it might have come to? €26.10. The 2 coffees were €6, so the €20.10 was for the rest. Talk about a ripoff. We'll never be there again, needless to say. I get where you're coming from. I think the days of an under tenner breakfast are gone, if not nearly gone anyway. I think some people might say that's not terrible. I know that sounds like I'm contradicting you. I'm not for a second. I think 12, 13 quid for a breakfast is probably with coffee around, but I suppose you'd expect to get the tea or coffee, wouldn't you? But you did get 2 Americans. So €26.10 for 2 poached eggs, beans, 2 slices of bacon, 2 poached eggs, beans, and 2 slices of toast and 2 slices of bacon, 2 Americano coffees, €26.10. I know where you're coming from. I think the problem for these businesses is, though, that they probably made 3 quid off that, 4 quid maybe maximum, and probably the most of the money they made was on the coffees because of the cost of everything nowadays. But anyway, we'll throw it out to the great listenership of the programme and see what they think. And on the issue of roads, morning, Greg. Could you shout out on air, the road at Carrick in Trent is a disgrace. The road is all potholes. It's that bad. If it's not fixed, the road will have to be closed. It's like that since Christmas. What are we paying tax for? It's time the council waken up and get it fixed. Thanks, Greg. On the issue of NCT, in for the NCT this week, you have to check on a machine. You have to check in on a machine. Few older people there knew nothing about them. Nobody at the counter for help. They had to get a person in for the test to do it for them. Right, so what that is certainly in Letterkenny is that when you arrive there, there is a little tablet to the left. I think it's the left the last time I was there. And you have to input your registration into it. It is actually kind of small and fiddly, I suppose. And that lets them know that you're there. I think they do call you, though, if you don't input it. But we'll get that double checked. We were talking yesterday about the outbreak of blue tongue down the country and the fact that it has led to the Chinese market being closed. A caller says, no wonder blue tongue is here. There's no checks on hay and straw being imported from where blue tongue is a problem. No checks on anything or anyone coming into Ireland. Our government have no understanding or care for the country. Only thing they care about is handy money and free float for themselves. Is that a fair enough criticism? Some would say there's over-regulation in that regard. Hi, Highland. I was just home from visiting my friend whose house is falling apart with defective concrete blocks. Then started reading about all the ministers going on holidays. This is, they're framing the St. Patrick's Day trips as holidays. And I thought, why not use that money we're spending on this nonsense, as they describe it, on these families who've got nowhere to go? Mothers and fathers stressed and worried about their kids getting hurt or worse, with blocks crumbling in their homes. Are we countries always mad when we spend thousands on, let's face it, trips that only give these people holidays at our expense? I, for one, would much rather my taxes being put to better use. I'm not nearly 80 now, and I remember myself and my friends got two beautiful Copine coats. Mine was a rose colour and hers was blue. We were the bees on ease. What's that in relation to? I wonder if another text topic slipped into mine. A lot of controversy yesterday with St. Noonan's, which I was reading up on the history of St. Noonan's College and the campaign and the efforts to get an extension to bring it up. They do amazing work down there with the facilities that they have, but much of it's an old building and it's seeing great growth and great success, but they're doing it in difficult circumstances. And I was reading some old news stories from 2018, 2019, and people were talking of fast-tracking it. I think the then Education Minister, Joe McHugh, was saying that, you know, we're fast-tracking it, things are improving and so on and so forth, or not progressing, not improving, things are progressing. And Charlie McConnell sent out positive vibes. It's not their fault. I'm not saying it's their fault that this hasn't progressed, but that was 2019. And tales were in the air that a big announcement for St. Noonan's was imminent. And then here we are, 2026, a multi-billion euro schools improvement package has been released and nothing for St. Noonan's. But a caller says, Greg, should St. Noonan's get a brand new school on a greenfield site? It's a very difficult place to access at present with poor facilities. Thanks, Daniel. I get where you're coming from, but there are brilliant plans there to improve it. And it's very traditionally there, if you know what I mean. But thanks for that. Another, why isn't St. Noonan's getting money? Get the Donegal government TDs on, or are they hiding away today too? There's no accountability in the Irish government, none at all. 98 billion budget this year. What are they spending the money on? Well, I mean, there's zero accountability on this programme from the government because the minister still won't speak to me. So now, I live in an area and have been fighting for 16 years to get something done about the coastal erosion at Ballinastocker. My house and other houses are currently at risk. We really need something done about it. It's interesting because we were talking to Councillor Liam Blaney yesterday about the coastal erosion there, and obviously it can often be, and this is not a criticism of the councillor, it can often be about, you know, tourism roads, access to beaches, but it's very interesting to hear from residents because they believe their houses are at risk. And if any of you are in that position, I'd love to speak to you because it's an angle we haven't taken on that specific issue yet. Back to St. Noonan's College. The government at the moment aren't funding extensions to schools run by the Catholic Church. They even get less contribution per head of student than state-run schools. Okay, I'm not sure about that. On to the issue of social media, and we'll be talking about this to our Friday panel, not extensively because we've talked about this a lot this week, but it seems the government are very keen to ban under 16s from using social media, and lots of you text in. This listener says, I got my 15-year-old a new phone at Christmas and thought, okay, at this age, he's old enough to have responsibility for his own account. The agreement was I could lift it at any time, anywhere, and check it. So one night, he went to bed, so I checked it. Then I realised he was talking to a girl who appeared to be 13 or 14, and it all seemed very innocent until I checked her followers, and she had 16,000 followers, which raised alarm bells. He didn't know who she was. She just added him on quick add on Snapchat. I started a conversation with her to see if she was innocent. Within minutes, she was sending naked videos and asking me for some. The Gardaí tell me there are groups who take profile pictures of innocent pages and use them and then blackmail young people into sending them money so their videos and photos won't be published. He's currently phoneless and accountless, and it's causing all kinds of rows between us. He says he now feels excluded from his friend's group, but in time he'll realise it's for his own protection. That's a very interesting story. And what a very clever parent here as well. So what the parent's talking about and what does happen is that someone will purport to be someone of the same age. So in this case, it sounds to me very much like a dirty old man or similar, or a woman, but most likely a fella, has pretended to be a 13 or 14 year old girl to engage in conversation with this 15 year old lad. They are prepared to send videos and pictures, which they've probably got from another source, not themselves, with the view of receiving images and videos in return. A, that is absolutely disgusting, illegal, and terribly exploitative and child abuse. But B, also, it could be used to blackmail that young lad. And if it wasn't for mum or dad there intervening, I think they could have been dealing with a very difficult or different situation. It's a horrible situation, as is. Regarding the figures on people caught driving under the influence in Donegal, what percentage of those actually result in a conviction, and how many never reach court due to loopholes in the law, legal technicalities, or even a quiet word on the side by someone of influence, all to undermine Garda efforts to make roads safer? It's a tough one, because you're actually asking people to sort of prove a negative, which is kind of impossible, but I don't know what the percentage is. We might put the feelers out and see if anyone can give us an anecdotal number. We were talking about the cost of eating out. Yesterday morning, two BLTs and two coffees. How much? €39. The answer is simple. I won't be going there again. Now we're getting into dinner prices there. Two BLTs, two coffees, €39. That's for lunch. Seems a lot. I got a coffee and a tea in Letterkenny. Cost €7.20. That's definitely a rip-off. €7.20 for a coffee and a tea. Now, I presume you sat in. Is it a rip-off? What do you think? We were down in Galway and three of us went out for lunch and there was two teas and a Coke. Oh, what? How much was it? It was €31, which I thought wasn't too bad at all, actually. That was down in the heart of Galway City. A caller says that is not a rip-off. I would consider under €13 for something each a very reasonable price. I'm leaning with you on that one, to be honest with you. And I don't have money to burn either. Hello, Greg. You can get a great breakfast in one local shop for €10, tea and coffee included. That's actually a Mr. Chippy. And the Friar's Rest as well, all tea and coffee you want. Very good value. That comes in from Union. Great breakfast, Donegal Town, includes tea and coffee and toast, €10, marinas, wine and coffee cafe. I appreciate you may not want to mention the name of the business. Well, listen, there's no harm in it. I've been in marinas. I would actually have spoken to Marina as well. She actually has an ethos about the price of food. And the one thing also about it too is your plate is wedged as well. It's not a box-ticking exercise. Let me see. On the air ambulance issue in France, a helicopter is dispatched if a road collision victim is 50 kilometers from the nearest hospital, not Ireland. Okay, so that's a protocol. Hello, Greg. You can get a read that one. Hello, Greg. In a school yesterday, pupils were in a room with the windows open or the window broke. The pupils were frozen and the teacher would not let the children wear their coats. This is completely unacceptable. Could you highlight this, please? It could have been a prefab. And lastly, on school grants before a break, daughter hoping to study in Belfast in September but won't qualify for the Susie grant. Do you know what help is available financially to students from Donegal who study in the north? Thank you. There's going to be loads of you listening that are in this situation. What supports are there, if any, if you send your child to study third level in Belfast or Derry or Coleraine or wherever it might be? If you have any advice for this listener, obviously they're thinking towards September and need some financial support. So it's a Donegal student who's going to be studying in the north. I really appreciate Donna Harper making her way into studio. Donna, we've overcome the technical issues. Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, not at all.
We're speaking in the context of you being invited to speak at a big event now in Derry. It's marking the 54th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. And there are families and campaigners from the Stardust tragedy, Hillsborough, the post office scandal, Ballymurphy, all coming together. When you first got the invite to this, did you sort of say, well, why am I being invited to this? A lot of these conversations are historic. What we're going through as a family and as a community is current.
Yeah, I did think that, but I was very humbled to be asked, because for me, Greg, it just made me realise and see that this is a major disaster, what happened here in Donegal. And definitely when you're being contacted by Maeve McLaughlin from the Bloody Sunday, who I would like to thank for her given us this opportunity to come over to her, just to talk about her struggles and what we're going through at the moment.
And I suppose what you're going through in your search for inquiries and accountability, it is very similar to these other cases. You're in the middle of a journey that they've been in for decades.
They've been in decades now, Greg, and I suppose like myself and a lot of other people here in Donegal, we grew up reading it and watching it in the media. Never did I think here now today I'd be standing fighting for justice for my own daughter. A lot of similarities there, obviously. These people have been going for decades. We've still got our Garda investigation still ongoing, which so far we're very happy with at the moment. We've no bother with that at the moment. But we are calling for the public inquiry, the Judicial Independent Statutory Public Inquiry. And it's very, very important to us because there's so many questions there, Greg. And you're not going to get them answered through just the criminal investigation with the guards. I'm sitting back here now, and if you go back to 1987, even into Raglan House, there was a gas explosion in 1987. The government, they compiled their own investigation there alongside a criminal investigation, alongside the coroner. I mean, that was done in 1987. And from that report then, they talked about it in the Dáil. They did investigations into looking at other buildings there at the time and see what they could do. And they did. They went ahead and they did works looking at buildings that maybe prolapse, collapse into buildings and stuff. And they did that and they went and looked about that. 1987, we're in 2026.
Mm.
So why can the government not do it here now for us?
And it's not just about, is it, you know, finding out the answers for yourselves. It's about, well, what lessons can be learned to ensure this is less likely to happen again?
Absolutely. I mean, where I'm sitting, the government have done nothing to do any kind of actions to try and make any changes in any kind of way. And they have to. It's very, very important that they have to. There's a public safety. Mm. Why are they not doing that? Why are they not stepping up here to look into these situations? Why are they not doing anything? And for us, it's really important that the public inquiry, we need that public inquiry.
Are you in a little bit of a difficult situation in progressing this, in that you did have a meeting with Jim O'Callaghan? Mm. I don't know exactly what was said at that meeting. I wasn't there. But from reports from it and an interview we did with you, he gave an indication that, yes, we get where you're coming from. Mm. This needs to happen. What's happened since then? I don't know when that meeting was. But, I mean, that you effectively could have said, all right, this is a minister that's listening to us. Let's see what he has to say then.
Yeah, well, it first came about that I had heard on, I think it was your own radio station, that he was coming to Donegal for other meetings. Through contacts that we have, we were able to make contact. And we were grateful that he gave us a few moments. But he's never actually sat down and spoke to us as a group, as a family. There's so many things there that we need to talk to him about. It was only a brief few moments that we had with him. He did very clearly make out that he wanted to go through, you know, the Garda and the criminal investigation and to go through, if there's evidence, to go through court and so on. And that's all good and well, but it's not going to answer the questions that all the families have. And there's some very significant questions there that need to be answered.
There are various views as to whether the type of inquiry you're looking for can run alongside a criminal investigation. Mm. Do we have to be careful that one doesn't stop the other getting the answers, or if there are people to be held responsible, to be held responsible?
Well, that's what they were saying to us, Greg. They were saying that government officials were saying that a way back. No, we can't. We need to wait for the guards. But in this country, there has been so many that has run side by side before, you know, and why can't it be done now?
What we also have in this county is inquiries into other matters that have been buried for a very long time as
very
well,
long
too.
Time.
So
yeah.
I think people can be understandably sceptical of it. I think there's a significance that you are joining scandals, people who have been badly affected by the Stardust tragedy. The post office scandal, that's the most current that feels like it's still ongoing. Of course, Grenfell, I think, might be represented as well, which also feels like it's ongoing. But, you know, Bloody Sunday, Hillsborough, you don't want to be here 10, 15, 20, 25 years trying to find out what happened to your daughter, how it happened, and how could that be prevented going on into the future?
No, we definitely don't, Greg. Like, this October now, it's going to be 4 years, and we do not want this. We don't want this dragging out for another 20 or 30 years. We are asking and pleading with the government now for a number of years to give us a commitment to sit down, have meaningful talks with us. And the meaningful talks is very important right now, because the Garda investigation is coming to a critical time now at the moment. The partial file had went last year. I think it was 29th of September last year that went. We were told that the other bit of the file will be going now in March. Now, once that's handed over, we have to wait then, obviously, on direction from the DPP. But does the government not think that they should be sitting down and having very serious talks with us, giving us some kind of commitment where we're going to go forward, instead of sitting here? That I don't want to be sitting here in 20 years' time, Greg, on Highland Radio again and saying, I'm still calling for a public inquiry. You know, it's very important to why is it all left on the families? Why are we left to be trying to fight
why
for truth and justice?
Why do victims become campaigners? Why do they have to become campaigners?
And we shouldn't, because the responsibility is on the government. I mean, an explosion happened. 10 people lost their lives. So many people were injured, traumatised. People lost their apartments. Why is the government not stepping in here to see what they can do that this never happens again? You know, and I think that's very important.
Would a timeline suffice if the minister or his rep said to you, as soon as the Garda investigation is concluded, we will instantly trigger a public inquiry? Do you think that would satisfy yourself?
Well, if they would sit down and talk to us, first of all, they haven't talked to us at all as a group.
Communication.
So there's no communication. There's a complete lack of communication with the bereaved families, with the survivors and so on, and people that lost their homes. There's no communication from government, from nobody. We've just been left here on our own, trying to battle through this on our own. Also trying to grieve, trying to go through milestones. For us, we've lost our loved ones. If the government would sit down and talk to us, if they would give us a commitment. And that's what we're asking for. It's very important.
Okay. It's a very important event to be part of. I think it will get a lot of attention, not just in this country, but across Britain as well and beyond, given the speakers that are there and the issues are being that are being covered. So we look forward to hearing what you have to say and the government's response to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And myself and some of the other families are going over there as well now on tomorrow, and we're looking very forward to meeting everybody and learning. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we'll be able to learn from these families who've been...
And vice versa too, I doubt.
Yeah, and, you know, decades and decades fighting for answers, fighting for the truth. And that gives us strength as well. When you've got people like that supporting you, gives you the strength to keep on going. But it's a learning curve for us, and we're very grateful to be there.
Donna, I know you're under in demand this morning, with which is a positive thing as well, and that's why it's good to get involved in these things to get that message out there. But thank you so much for calling up to us.
No, not at all. Thank you, Greg.
Well, Lizzie Hughes is a very popular lady today. Can you wish our wonderful granny and great granny, Lizzie Hughes, a happy 90th birthday for today from the O'Hagan family, Castlefin? Could Greg please play a special birthday request for Lizzie Hughes from Castlefin? She's celebrating her 90th birthday today. Lots of love from daughter Alice Rose, son-in-law Lawrence, grandkids and partners, Damien and John, Aaron and Nadine, Anthony and Courtney, and three great-grandkids, Blake, Elvie and Hayley. Can you please wish Lizzie Hughes in Lisnamulligan, Castlefin, a very happy 90th birthday? This is from Eileen McGee in Ballybuffet. And another one for you, Lizzie. From Deborah, Brian and Jude, love you loads.
The Friday panel on The Greg Hughes Show.
Okay, good morning to you. Katie Tyrrell McCafferty, Community Campaigner. Great to have you back on the show.
Good morning, Greg.
Thank you for joining us. We also have Independent Senator Eileen Flynn. Hi, Eileen.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Always a pleasure. And Rebecca McDade, Chair of Ainthwyn in Donegal. How are you keeping, Rebecca?
Good morning, Greg. Sorry about these windows behind us, but I'm in a room full of them, so I can't cover them up.
Don't you worry about it. I wouldn't have noticed if you didn't mention. Right, just a quickie, I suppose, to get things started. Do you think the government will follow through on its tough talk to ban under-16s from social media? And are there any downsides to this, Rebecca?
I think that they're going to have to do it, Greg, you know, because there is so much negativity on the online, and the children are actually really using it a lot for their social media rather than for educational purposes and educational needs. And I do think that, you know, it affects their attention span as well, because when you're using TikTok and it's a quick, quick, quick flick of everything, you know, they really need to just be able to pull that back and just kind of reduce the availability of it, because they're not always able to contextualize a lot of the information they're allowed to get on it as well, you know. There's another aspect of it, like their parental responsibility, to make sure that they don't have the infinite access to everything on the phone. And I know it's very, very hard, but in a time that we're in now, and there's so many dangers out there, the parents need to take responsibility for that. We can't allow the children to completely, as I said, police it themselves. So we've got to be able to back them up on that, and we have to help them through that. So reducing their ability to get information is one of the key options here.
Someone said to me yesterday that, are we failing as parents? Do we need the government to legislate for anything? Should it not be us that determine whether or not our children are old enough for social media and to supervise their access to it, rather than this outright ban?
It's too freely available, Greg. There's too many people with so much influence there, and there's a lot of money to be made in the content. So when you look at that end of things, parents are not going to be able to do everything on their own. They're going, there has to be, it has to come from higher up, and there has to be legislation on it. And it's actually something that I would have been asking for a way back in 2019. It was something that we talked about, that there needs to be legislation on mobile phones for the underage, because children are getting the phones younger and younger.
Yep.
So we need that. That's where the parental side comes into it, that we need to delay their access to the phones to that little bit older.
Yeah, I think it's to help parents, really. Eileen Flynn, as a legislator, I suppose, would you welcome this ban? Do you see any downsides?
I'm in negotiations at the moment with the Ombudsman for Children, and I think it's really important that we, as was said in one of the committees yesterday, the Children's Committees, the Ombudsman for Children would have said that, you know, we're putting this responsibility on children, we're punishing children and young people once again. For me, Greg, I care very much for young people and the safety of young people and social media. I brought in a piece of legislation that that Jim O'Callaghan is carrying through the Dáil very soon around child pornography and online, etc. And for me, I think we need to tease it out. I work with my colleagues in Australia, and I think, you know, I'm not a believer in punishing our children. And then, like, you know, would it be secretive? Like, are they going to hide the phone? I'd rather know, what are they doing online? You know, like, I have 2 wee girls, and I'm going to try my best and not leave them on social media apps, if you want, and the likes of Facebook or TikTok until they're 16, 17. And I have a level, myself and Liam has a level of responsibility as parents. And as a qualified youth worker, and a community development worker, I also think we can't blame parents if young people are on social media. So it's a conversation I think we have to have as a society. I wouldn't just push it and say yes just because Australia has done it and France has done it. Would I look at maybe under 13s on social media? Would I legislate for that? I probably would, yes. But I think, like, you know, we have great youth work nowadays in this country. We have a academic, like, education, if you want, not done in a classroom. And I think, you know, we need to invest in our youth organisations and in parents when we train our young people around the safety of online and the trust that our young people, our children, need to have in us as parents too, I think is really important.
So am I fair in saying that you're broadly speaking in favour of it, but you believe that maybe the age at which this kicks in should be open for conversation? I don't want to put words in your mouth, Eileen, but is that...
Yeah, I'd need to really look at it, Greg.
Yeah.
I'd need to see in about another 4 or 5 months how's the ban doing in Australia. You know, would it go on to... And this may seem a little bit dramatic, but would it go on to the black market where young people are buying phones Like from I don't know how to say this.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah, backhanded stuff. Yeah, I know what you mean.
I'd really think about keeping young people safe, and I guess that's the youth worker in me. You know, like I believe young people at the age of 16 have the capacity to vote. Now I know they don't vote. You know, like I have a sister that got married at 15 years of age, and I know that's going back like. Years ago, and it was the norm even for Irish people in general back then to get married at a younger age. Like we all grew up, well, I did anyway, grew up with TV, you know, and you come back from school, you'd have your television. And like for me, my children don't really watch TV. I'd give them, like, they do have two tablets.
Yeah.
You might be on the tablet
no one watches TV at that age anymore. It's YouTube maybe is their TV channel or something. That is just the days of scheduled TV for people that were born, you know, within the last 20 years are finished. There's no doubt about that. I'll come back to you, obviously. Katie Tyrrell McCafferty. It's an interesting... I think what Eileen has brought into the conversation, you know, it is quite nuanced. One 15-year-old's very different to another 15-year-old, and you're using one solution for all. What's your view, Katie?
Really interesting, Greg. So I was actually in the car with my 20-year-old yesterday, and this subject came up, and I said, I would broadly be in favour of this, and he said, old people's problems. Solution. And he said, and it made a really interesting point, and we've touched on it here, right? We've asked, is this the legislators? Do they need to do this? Is it the parents? Why are we not blaming the tech companies for what they allow to go on their social media platforms? Greg, there was a really, really disturbing TikTok live the other night that had 10,000 watchers. Some of the people involved in that live were very, very young, with no clothes on. On TikTok, It was a mass-reported live. I had a friend of mine who reported the live, and she got a violation for reporting the live 3 and 4 times. The tech companies do need to take responsibility
so here. Are you saying that we need to see if we can make it a safer place for under 16s before we have an all-right ban? Do you want to do what are you in favor of Senator Flynn's suggestion? Wait and see what's happening in other countries, like, because we do have to sort of figure a way forward at this point too.
Absolutely, we have to figure a way forward, and we have to have a conversation about it. And I you know, a bit like the Citizens Assembly, we need to involve young people in that as well. I'm not saying the trolling's not getting out of hand and stuff, but in my house, and I do think because particularly one of my kids, because of his special interests in certain areas, because he's on the autism spectrum, obviously, social media was used in a really positive way, YouTube and stuff like that. And a lot of the times, if you're in a classroom and you can't retain the information, it was really good to be able to go on to the likes of YouTube and stuff and get information. I'm thinking of someone that creates really good content. He's a local man, John Ruddy, who does his potted history series.
But I suppose
YouTube,
the idea would be that if there was an outright ban, that you might sit a child down with your tablet and it's more supervised, right? So in other words, rather than opening the floodgates for the Yeah, I get you. Are any of you...
Greg,
yes,
could I just say one final point on this, if it's okay? I think it's all well and good that Simon Harris comes out with statements that he's able to throw around, like banned social media for under 16s without speaking to under 16s. Exactly what Kay has said there, without putting the responsibility on these multinational tech companies. And I think that's the responsibility of the government, is keeping our children safe. And how to do that is go to the big boys at the top and say, this is how we do it in Ireland, you know. And I think it's really, really important that we stop punishing young people and the hands of billionaires that think it's okay to have nude images of children.
But it's the activity
online
of adults that we're trying to protect them from, isn't it? Let's not forget that.
Yeah.
Rebecca.
Yeah.
Rebecca, you, I started with you and you know, you were very much in favour of the under-16s, teasing it out a little bit, so maybe you're an outlier or not. Having listened to the two other guests there, do you believe we need something a little bit more nuanced, more engagement with young people? Maybe look at whether it's under-16, under-13, or do you believe, or do you remain firm in your view, under-16s, we need the ban?
Well, I do think that under-16s, we still need a ban because the children are not always able to give the answers correctly and contextualise everything. But I do think that, yes, it is a good thing to talk to them, there's no doubt about it, and have their opinions. But this is where you have to draw the line between a child and the adult. And the adult has to make a decision as to what is the correct thing to happen for a child, because it all depends on the age. And the main thing that all of us are saying this morning is communication. Open the line of communication and debate for the subject. For a long time, it was closed and you didn't get the opportunity to really to speak about it. So I think that the fact that everybody now is at different, coming at it from different angles, all of those things, the communication is paramount.
I think we also to presume there is this perfect makeup of a family, perfect structure, perfect income, perfect everything, and trying to apply rules for everyone based on this notion where it's not really the case at all. And you could have a 15-year-old who's the principal carer in a house, for an example. So they are responsible for looking after mum, say, for instance, who might have a life-limiting condition, but they couldn't go on TikTok. You know, so it is, not everybody is just this notion that we have maybe of
it's the dangers, Greg, that needs to be looked at. It's the areas of danger. So it's not necessarily the educational side of things. So all of those lines of communication can be left open. But the danger that you have is that there are so many out there that pose to be good when they're not. So how do you police that?
Quick run around.
You have to draw a line somewhere.
A quick run around. The truth is, regardless of what anyone says, the only way you can prove someone is not 16 or less is that everybody who is 16 and over proves that that's their age. Are you happy with this data being in the hands of these social media companies? Do you think it's a good thing? Just a quick comment, Eileen, from you. I'll ask the other two guests then as well, because obviously to make sure everybody is over 16, everybody has to prove their age, and that means proving their identity.
Look, Greg, you're not meant to smoke until you're 18. I started smoking at 12 years of age. It didn't stop me from smoking. And I'm not condoning it or anything. I'm just saying that, like, young people are young people. They'll tease things out for themselves. And I just think it's we could be going down a very, very dangerous rabbit hole. How are we going to educate our young people at 15, 16 to be safe online if they don't have these platforms, if we don't trust them online? I do believe something needs to be done. Right now, as I'm speaking about, right now, as I'm here, I don't know what the solution is. I'm going to have to tease it out more. And again, I think Simon Harris and Micheál Martin, before they introduce any bans of legislation, they need to work with the tech companies, to hold the tech companies to responsibility. End of story.
Katie, do you think
that when it comes to age,
yep,
they can lie about their age? Young people are not stupid.
Well, they're scrunching up their faces in Australia to try and give the impression they've got wrinkles, but we might not use that kind of system. Age verification. Katie, what do you think? Will everyone over 16 be happy to give their details, their personal details, to social media companies?
If you are using your platform in the correct way, then
nothing to hide.
And we know troll. And the other thing, will this... Right, we know
what
about troll accounts.
What about then?
Bots?
Yeah, okay, I get you. But then what about those that use social media to highlight atrocities in the world? Maybe it could be women speaking out in a country that if they dared bare their face, they could have their head taken off them, you know. There's a whole cohort of people that maybe might not be able to campaign or get that information out, because the only way they could is to provide their identification. And can we trust big tech, big governments not to share that out?
This is why this is such a nuanced problem, is because there may be women in Iran who are campaigning against the leadership, the hijab
or whatever it might
be. And the compulsory wearing of the hijab. That's what I'm saying. It's a very nuanced situation, and we could jump too quickly into ban this, ban that. We know you can go back to prohibition, banning alcohol. Do you know what I mean? And there was ways around it.
Yes, but the majority of young people, thankfully, don't smoke. The majority of young people don't drink. There will always be those that will. And I was amongst them as well, that will find a way around that, okay? But you introduce laws to denormalise things, to not sort of give some sort of tacit approval of it, right? So, you know, we know there's going to be kids who go around the rules, but maybe if the spaces they're in aren't populated by millions of other children, it's not worth it, Rebecca. What do you think of that argument?
Well, you see, it depends on who is going to, for me, it just depends on who's going to police everything and be able to get the legislation through and how they control it. Because as we know, the government is trying to control the narrative on a lot of things, even in our media. So the children need to have the media, they need to have a platform that they know will be good, that they know will be not influenced by one side or the other. They need something that's going to be very balanced.
This is why I find platforms like this so interesting, because, you know, Simon Harris, and this is no disrespect to other journalists, he's just been able to go on Virgin Media yesterday morning, RT in the afternoon, and just lay it out there. And yet here we have, I think we're all parents as well, we have a situation whereby, you know, through life experience, we talk about, you know, the reality of what this might bring. And that's really, really valuable, rather than effectively PR exercise interviews, which I generally try and avoid. So it's been really interesting to get all of your views on that. If you need to grab a coffee, I'm going to be 4 minutes. We'll be back with more from Independent Senator Eileen Flynn, Rebecca McDade, Chair of Aintho in Donegal, and Katie Tyrrell McCafferty, Community Campaigner. So more than 36,000 new homes were completed across the country last year. It's an increase of 20% in 2024, but it does fall short of the government's prediction in early 2025. 681 were completed in Donegal. Over half, in fact, of the 36,000 new homes were completed in and around Dublin. Katie Tyrrell McCafferty, does the government deserve credit for increasing house completions year on year, a record year when compared to, the highest number since 2018 when these figures were starting to be compiled?
Obviously, any social housing is...
It's all housing, by the way, just to be clear, I believe.
Oh, so it's not...
I don't know, actually, now that you say that. Is it all social housing? I haven't a clue. No, I think
it's social housing. It's a move in the right direction. It's still not enough. But as well as that, we have an housing crisis. We know we have an housing crisis. And then we have our own mini housing crisis in Donegal with mica and defective blocks. No, it's not enough. No, the government haven't met its target. So... you can't really congratulate them on that, because it's another empty promise.
Well, you don't have to worry about it next year, because we don't do targets anymore. So you can't...
Oh, right, so that's great.
We targets are finished with.
You know, we'll have goals that we want to reach, whether it be in a personal capacity or building social housing. The other thing that we need to look at is empty property as well, bringing stuff back into housing stock as well. But yeah, if that's not a social housing,
no, it's
figure,
all
then...
housing, isn't it, Eileen? It's all housing. That is, it's all.
Yeah, as far as I know, it's all housing.
It is. Yeah,
Kate.
It is. Yeah.
It's affordable. It's private. You know, you name it, it's there. For me, Greg, I wouldn't pat the government on the back for doing what they said they were going to do, and most importantly, I have to say, it's not enough, far from enough. You go on to the streets of Dublin, you see
Like, you, even say if someone had an appointment in the Mater Hospital or something, a lot of Donegal people would have to travel for healthcare. They will see the level of homelessness, the level of women and children and men homeless in our country. Now, they built over 30,000 houses, absolutely brilliant. I welcome all that when it comes to, like, I'm working with families here in Ardra who are homeless. I'm working with single mothers who are homeless, children in this country who are living in overcrowded accommodation. So for me, it's not enough. It's just like mental health, Greg. You know, they're patting themselves in the back. They're doing a great job. But then, see, they don't have to live in these communities where, like, and even in Donegal, there's a lot of social houses in this county that's impacted by the defective concrete. And that's not spoken about. It's not addressed. I've tried numerous of times to get that a standalone issue around the social housing.
Well, we're waiting on. I spoke to the housing minister on this early last year, that when he was up, the newly he said a scheme for social houses was imminent. Who was I speaking to recently? A councillor yesterday or the day before. They said that the minister said that they would have a scheme for social housing in a matter of weeks. That was towards the end of last year. So whatever's going on, this scheme is not forthcoming. We're being told it's in the works, but where is it?
Yeah, and will it be future-proofed for the families, you know, because it's dampness in the houses. And there's a lot around traveller accommodation as well in this county where the infected concrete, and that's not even spoken about. You know, there's some people in this county living in appalling accommodation underneath the social housing. And that's a failure of local authorities. It's a failure of government. And, you know, you said there you're talking to the new minister. We have new ministers every few years and they have to get. I just think the government, like, I'm at a place right now where I'm so frustrated with the health, with housing, mental health, childcare. Really, Greg, things are getting so much worse.
I think it's six ministers now have asked when will the report into housing in Donegal be released. You'd be familiar with that. And it's always soon, or it's on my desk, or we're reviewing it. For families in Ardra, 123 houses were finished in Glenties last year. Don't know what the breakup of that is in terms of social or private, but 123 need far more than that to address the issues. Just for people in other electoral areas, 150 were completed in the Letterkenny Municipal District, 128 in the Donegal Municipal District, 123 in Glenties, 108 in Lifford, Stranorlar, 76 in Milford, 56 in South Inishowen, 52 in North Inishowen, and there is something in the region of 760 commencements in 25. So that number might go up, but as again, we don't know what kind of houses they are. And I very strongly suspect that they're including derelict properties in that, which doesn't tell a good picture. I'm really keen to find out if the derelict properties are in that Donegal figure. Rebecca, you know, you can frame it one way or other, another a record-breaking amount of houses or another failed promise.
Yeah, well, I think most people will know that I'm not a great fan of the government either. So, but we talk about the statistics, and we have to look at the elephant in the room. And that is the fact that there's 50,000 people born every year, 20,000 people die. So there's a difference there of 30,000 of population who will all need housing of some description at some time. And there's no planning for it at all. The other thing you have to look at, yes, as Eileen has mentioned, and Katie has mentioned there, I think, too, with the defective blocks, there's no, even if you say there, North Inishowen, only 52 houses in Inishowen. Look, it's ridiculous that the planning is not there, that they have not looked ahead. Everything that they do should be planning for the 10, the 15, the 20 years' time, as well as trying to plan for the here and now. And that has not happened. The other problem that you have is when stock is low for houses, there's a demand for them, which ultimately leads to the increase of revenue. And that goes mainly for the government. There's a revenue there for the government, not only the selling agent. So you have to think, well, why is there a shortage of housing? So where is the money going that they're getting from the revenue of all of that as well? When you have the sale of the houses, and the increase in the price of the houses is immense.
Well, so I think that's former policy, in that, you know, what happened was, is, or what does tend to happen is, when things get tight in the economy, spending on housing, spending on infrastructural programs is all pulled back. Now, what they're saying going forward, that's not going to happen. So really, this is a hangover from the crash where all activity stopped, and we're chasing our tails to try and catch up again, but we won't do that into the future.
Yeah, but I wouldn't allow them to say that, you see, and I wouldn't allow them to have that look on it, because how much money did they give to the World Bank in recent times?
Mm.
Where's that money going?
The only
Where's
thing I'll
money,
say...
What's that money paying for?
I don't
and
want to
why
be...
has the money been taken off the Irish people and yeah. those who are living here in this country, paying their taxes? Where is our money going? We can want I... to know where it's
but
going.
But just in relation to that, if you don't mind, Rebecca, and I don't want to be argumentative, we can then yeah. talk about the $25 million to Ukraine, the $50 million to that. The truth is though, we have billions upon billions of money in reserves in this country. So, like, saying $50 million went to the World Bank, $25 million to Ukraine, you know, $10 million to Palestine, that money was never going to go into housing people in this country. We have, as I say, billions of euro that we're not spending in this country.
Our hard-earned money,
are you
money,
not giving, yeah, but are
it's
you not
crazy.
Giving, in a way, when someone in opposition like yourself says that, are you not giving the government a pass? Because it's as if they're making decisions, choosing one over the other. No, the decision is not to pump the money that's there into the Irish people. It's not to send it elsewhere. They're sitting on it for a rainy day. 111 billion euro we took in tax last year. 11 billion in corporation tax. That 25 million, that 15 million, that 50 million, it's a huge amount of money, but it's
massive.
Pittance, it's poxy. They're
yeah.
sitting on the money. And yeah. now what happens is instead of us going at the government, or you going at the government, not me, you're going at the Ukrainians or the World Bank or the Palestinians. Brilliant. If I'm a decision maker, I'm going, brilliant, you're doing my work for me, because you're not having a go at me. You're having a go at the Palestinians and the Ukrainians, Rebecca. And it plays, I think, into their
Well,
hands.
I'm not having a go at them.
No,
what
you,
I'm
no,
saying
you
is,
know what I mean. You know what I mean. I'm
yeah,
not having a go
no,
at
well, it's just to be clear that I mean that they're telling us that there's no money for our health. There's no money for housing. The government wants us, as we talked about before, the government wants small landlords to allow people to rent their homes for 6 years now. That's to buy them 6 years, right, where they can plan now to try and build these houses. But they're using the small landlords to do that. But they're also putting them in a terrible predicament where they're caught within this net of... where they have to abide by a certain rule in order
so
to allow these people
the private
to stay
sector,
there.
The private sector but, is the solution to the public problem,
Greg,
isn't it? Yeah, that's
just,
what you're saying. Yes, Eileen, go
just
ahead.
Make one final point on budget, because it seems like you were talking about the budget now, right? Every year, okay, when the government announces more money has been spent on health, never as much money spent on housing, or we haven't done this since 2018, blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm no economic person, but believe me and you, I was born and reared in poverty. I know exactly what it's like to live in rundown accommodation and where services are not met by local authorities. I get all that. But when the cost of living goes up, the biggest Egypt in the room would know this. When the cost of living goes up, of course the government is going to invest more. So we're always told that, even take Letterkenny Hospital for an example. You know, the Minister for Health just said we'd never invest so much money in Letterkenny Hospital. You go into Letterkenny Hospital this minute, all of the staff are overworked, a lot of the staff are run down, burnt out. And people, you know, so where's this money is not shown on the ground. So
okay.
I agree with Rebecca, it's not shown on the ground, the investment that the government
doesn't trickle down.
Is giving into
no.
communities.
There was potentially, a quick line on that, because there was something really quite significant happened yesterday, I think. And it was comments again from Simon Harris, because he's doing the political rounds. And he started talking about the right to housing in this country and who has rights to housing and who doesn't have rights to rising. And some said it was dishonest and dangerous dog whistling. Do any of you believe that linking the housing crisis so explicitly as he did to migration is a necessary step in honest policy making? Or even maybe, Katie, is it a political tactic to displace blame from the government's failures, in inverted commas, to meet the housing targets they set themselves? Because he was saying, like, about half the people that are looking for social housing have no right to it anyway. Katie, unmute yourself just before you speak, if you don't mind, my dear. Katie, unmute. I want to hear you. Go ahead.
It's the classic divide and conquer rule. Classic divide and conquer. What this country needs is a national house building program. And by doing that, you can save money, right? The money that we give out to private landlords, I accept that there are small private landlords, but there are a lot of big private landlords. A lot of them actually sit in the Doyle as well, let's be honest about it. We know that. How many of them in the Doyle are landlords, right? So we're paying out money on private rents. We're using hotels as emergency accommodation as well. All of that money can be saved if we have a national house building program. And then look at the benefits beyond that. If it's taken under the intergovernment wings, we can have apprenticeships for people that are looking to start in the building trade, electrics and all that. All of that, and it would have to be to a really good standard as well. I'm fed up of seeing accommodation that is not of good standard. To be, if you're in a defective house, right, by the way, if you're in a defective social housing house, I would take the case to court and not pay. I would not pay my rent because it's not fit for purpose.
Yeah, but then you end up on a debtor's list. I get where you're coming from, but that doesn't. 20% of TDs are landlords, by the way. You asked that question. I know it was rhetorical, but 20% are. That's actually come down a bit, but it's an overrepresentation because 20% of us in society aren't. Landlords. Eileen Flynn, Simon Harris's comments. Do you think it was an honest conversation about policy making or deflection?
He's a leader that talks out of every part of his body, if you want. I can't make heads or tails of him, to be fair. You know, he's against the far right. And then he comes out and he divides the conquer right once again. Everybody deserves a home. It's a basic human right.
And I just want to bring Rebecca in this before the end of the programme. Rebecca, did you welcome Simon Harris's referencing to the demand on housing and people's entitlement to housing, whether they're immigrants or not, and that needs to be clarified? Or do you believe Minister Harris was displacing blame?
100%, he's just displacing blame. You know, you've got to think about, if we don't have enough, we have to look at the resources that we have, and if we don't have enough houses for our people that are here in Ireland, that are living here, then how can we possibly give accommodation and resources to others? So there has to be money spent in those areas, and we have seen that in Letterkenny and in our towns and villages all over. Donegal here, when we come from the different areas, we have seen where certain types of accommodation or buildings have been turned into accommodation to accommodate migrants. I'm not saying anything about them. What I'm saying is you are dividing the people and you're causing an anger and you're raising that every single day that you ignore the people that are from your country that are basically trying to get housing, sitting on a housing list. One girl has told me she was told she'd be on the housing list for about 10 years. And you do have the situation where you have migrants that are coming in and they're being housed in certain buildings that has turned into accommodation. And they're getting accommodation over and above the people that are here. And they're saying
that's not suitable accommodation.
What the government is doing is putting people in hotels and in hostels, run down old buildings. And that note that we're dividing the conquer, a young woman from Letterkenny met a very brave TikTok here a few days ago about her brother experiencing racial and hatred comments on the streets of Letterkenny. The young woman spoke about her mother being in working in the hospital for many years as a psychiatric doctor, and she also spoke about her father being a consultant to our children in the hospital. She was born and reared in this county.
But you're dividing the people again.
I can't allow you to say that. The government are paying hotel owners. They're investing in hotel owners while we have a housing crisis. Exactly what Kate had said earlier, invest in social housing.
Okay, well, Rebecca
I can't agree with that. In total, I will agree on some of it in part, but not all of it.
If you don't agree with that, you believe in the government giving money to hotels.
Rebecca, I got your point, and listeners will as well, and they can make up their own minds. Have a great weekend. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Eileen Flynn, thank you so much for joining us. And Katie, look forward to chatting to you really soon. Going live in just a couple of moments. It's a very interesting conversation with Bernadette Rice. She's the latest guest in our series of Greg Hughes podcasts, sister podcasts to this program. Get it where you get your podcasts. And a former guest was Jerry McKeever. We were speaking to him about his views on democracy. He's got a book out, Saving Democracy, A Proactive Plan. And he's going to be signing copies tomorrow between 2 and 4 p.m. at the Bookmark Letterkenny Shopping Centre. Have a fantastic weekend, everybody. We really appreciate you listening throughout the course of the week.